Will.
Oh, yeah.
So what?
What?
Mm-hmm.
What about what? what?
In the butt?
You're well, yeah. Number three.
I'll stay with you.
It's a hat trick. You're welcome for three things today. Beep, 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 beep.
Shoo, boop.
Yeah, I just got off an airplane.
Sure did.
Came straight here from the airport. We had a minute to kill, so we went to the RFs.
We did.
She's barely on social media, so she probably doesn't know what I did yesterday.
You filmed a thing at Helium.
I directed.
Directed. Yes, I saw it. I liked
you did.
It. Okay. I liked it.
Oh, did you see it on Facebook?
Instagram.
It wasn't. Oh, she does. Okay.
I did. I saw it on.
She pays attention to me.
I do.
She lurks.
I saw it on the Instagram. So yeah.
I didn't mean to hijack the opening of this.
No. That's fucking no, dude. That's
that was cool.
Fucking super cool.
I'm a co-director on a comedy special.
Yeah.
Now.
Look at you.
It's real fucking cool.
For River Butcher.
You're kind of a big deal.
River Butcher
kind of
is
like us.
Very funny.
Yes, River Butcher is extremely funny.
He's very, very funny. Yeah. Did you want to tell everybody what you told me this morning?
Ooh.
Oh.
Speaking of being a director?
That's not 100% yet.
Oh, that's fine. The fact that it made me need to lay down on the shower floor for a little bit.
Did you actually lie down on the shower floor as a result?
No, but I was about to get in the shower when I said it anyway. I thought about it. And I'm like,
mm. Yeah. I think there's a fairly decent chance we're going to reshoot the short.
Yeah.
The entirety.
That
face was how I feel inside.
The entirety. Just too many variables within the reshoots that need to be done to make it actually look good.
Cohesive, so it just redoes.
Yeah. The way I summed it up for Z was Jason, the director of photography, and I want to make the best version of this script, and what we have is not the best version.
Okay. Fair enough.
So.
Which is fair. I actually expected you to say that like a week ago when we were talking about it, I think.
To be honest, I haven't looked really at much of the footage at all. You know what it was?
Well, you guys have both been busy as fuck.
So busy, but I popped it in because I asked Jason about the audio, if I had the audio. He goes, oh, it should be on the drive. So I popped the drive in and I looked at one clip and it was the scene of the dolly pulling back with the blanket.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember this when we were shooting, but it just didn't sink all the way in.
Yeah.
When they took the headboard off, you can see the screw holes in the wall.
Oh.
They're not covered up at all.
Whoops.
There's just four holes in the wall in the shot. And I'm like, well, that looks stupid. And that's in a lot of the shots. That's in a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So there's just stuff like that.
Just little things.
That because we had to undress and redress everything, and we were at my friend's house, so we couldn't paint or go and like drill or do any of that because we had to put it back exactly the way it was, which apparently I failed to do, which is part of the reason why we can't do reshoots. That, it's not super viable. There are things that we did shoot that I am incredibly proud of.
Nice. Good.
There are elements in there that I fucking love and that I really want to make sure we capture correctly again. And now that we have source material, I feel like it'll be really easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it's not where I don't want my directorial debut for something like that to be what we have.
Gotcha.
That's fair. That's why I called you and Jason both.
Stanley Tubrick.
I was like, you are now together one entity known as Tubrick.
Yep.
But, you know, think about it this way. Like, major motion picture films, they shoot multiple scenes.
Well,
one scene
shoot,
multiple times,
they'll
you
shoot,
know?
They'll shoot over the course of a few weeks or a few months, or in the case of, like, Richard Linklater, a few years.
Yeah, and that's like, hey, we need to reshoot that one. Like,
yeah, and then they will schedule time to go reshoot stuff.
Right.
So it's certainly part of the process. It was just one with the amount of content in the script I was hoping to avoid, but here we are.
Well, you know, hey, it's movie magic. It's unavoidable.
I'll take what I have, cut a trailer, we'll launch a Kickstarter, we'll also look for local funding, and then bring a crew on board, probably go 4 days instead of three, and then do the goddamn thing.
Do the fucking thing. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
Welcome to Ghosts and Hoes!
Ghosts and Hoes!
Ghosts and Hoes! A paranormal podcast where we talk about all things spoopy. Cryptids. Mm-hmm. Aliens.
Yeah.
Motherfucking witchcraft.
Yeah.
Murder most motherfucking foul. Space ocean.
Yeah.
Weird shit. Definitely. All around.
Definitely, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Things that make me lay on the floor of my shower. Yes.
That too. That too.
You were none too thrilled to hear that, but...
I wasn't, but also I was expecting it for some reason.
Probably because I had told you we were already going to do reshoots.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I told you, like, in the back... I think the words I said to you were, in the back of my mind, I really want to reshoot the whole thing.
Yeah,
that's
true.
That's not a viable option. And now a week later, after talking to Jason, I'm like, JK. That's it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're just going to do the whole
thing. And I was like, well, yeah, just let me lay on the floor for the next few months about it.
And it'll be at least that long until we're ready.
I know. So,
that's how movies work sometimes. Yeah. So
just talking about it makes me tired all over again.
Fair. Retiring days.
Oh, my God. Yes. But yeah, hi, guys.
Hi, hi.
It feels like it's been a long time. It hasn't.
It's been exactly a week.
Yeah, exactly a week. Right? It feels like longer, though.
It does, which is really weird.
I think maybe because you were out of town. I don't know. Yeah. I can't explain it. I don't know. It just feels like it's been longer than a week.
So it could. I mean, maybe because we had a holiday?
No. We were here. I don't know.
Yeah, we were here.
That,
no, I know.
Yeah, I don't
know. But, you know, the holiday kind of makes it feel kind of long. I don't know.
I don't fucking know.
I don't either. I can't explain it. Just like I cannot and will not explain why Gwyneth Paltrow is Drew Barrymore's Wario.
There you go.
I can't explain it. I won't explain it, but it makes sense.
I mean, I can give it a shot.
Yeah, we don't need to. If you don't get it, then that's on you.
Here's what I will say. If you want to get it, watch the Drew Barrymore Hot Ones interview.
Yes.
Then you'll get it.
Then you'll get it.
Well, see, and now I've heard that she has an entire cookware line at the Walmart.
She does.
And I need to fucking go see it all.
She does. It's very cute.
I need to see it all.
I seen it in person. Some of the things. They had the air fryer. They would look very good in
here. Are you going to the Clackamas Walmart?
Yeah, there's only one now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I used to go to the one by the theater.
Yeah.
But they closed it.
Yeah, right.
Which sucked at Delta Park. Mm-hmm. Which also sucked. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was just there. I don't need an air fryer. I had to take back Hank Grill because he did not fit on my counter. And I got a new one and I decided his name will be Rusty Shackleford.
Nice.
Why? I don't know.
Because you've been watching King of the Hill.
Also that, but it's a ninja brand and it just made me think pocket sand. Yeah. Rusty Shackleford. Pocket sand. Yeah, it also, one of the features, it dehydrates things. So that could be fun.
Mine does too.
I was like, I don't know what I'm going to dehydrate, but I'm going to fucking
do
it.
Do we have the same one?
Maybe.
Fruit, man. Fruit.
How much was it?
I don't remember. It was on sale. It was like, I think maybe $119 or something.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Mine's also a ninja and it dehydrates.
I had a gift card.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, we're on sale. I'm like, even better. Mm-hmm. Give it.
I got mine during pandemic assistance time.
Nice.
I was like, yeah, we're getting a fucking air fryer. We're going to make some fucking green puffs.
Yeah.
Here we go.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah. All right. So that's
got all. Any backups?
Oh, of course.
Well, let's do it.
Several many.
Well, only three, but they're little bit lengthier. Two of them are.
Jesus Christ. You're killing me.
The first one is just Happy Pride.
Yeah,
because this is the first one we've recorded in June. So happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
We love you and we support all of you. And if you have any people in your life that aren't that way, we're officially your aunties now. Do you need a snack? Have you had any water? Those jeans make your butt look really cute.
Yes.
Also, if you call yourself an ally and you haven't put a dick in your mouth or butt, you're not an ally.
Well, I'm an ally. There you go. About that.
So yeah, there's that. And then I've been seeing this going around on the interweb.
By the way,
again.
I was kidding. If anybody's offended by what I just said, it was a joke.
My son might be.
He's like, I don't need to know. To quote you.
I was totally lying.
Your parents fuck.
I made it up.
Yeah.
And you said that to me, so I'm just saying it again.
Yeah, your parents fuck.
You don't have to like it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's true.
If you're offended, I mean, I guess you can write in, but it's a joke.
He doesn't get offended. He just gets really grossed out.
No, not. I'm saying anybody
in
who just heard that.
In general.
Yeah.
But yes, this one I've seen making the rounds on the interweb again. The ID of the Zodiac Killer. Nothing has changed.
Nothing.
That's the same information from when it came out about a year and some change ago. Mm-hmm. Same guy. Nothing. No evidence has been confirmed. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, whatever evidence this man claims to have has not been produced. Mm-hmm. At least not, like, he hasn't said what he has. He's just like, I got it. Well, okay. But until I have that information from, like, an official source, like mm-hmm. the task force or law enforcement, it's not solved. So, just so you are aware, because we've been sent that a lot. Mm-hmm. They're like, look at him. I'm like, this is old. Like, mm-hmm. the article may have just been written, but there's nothing new in there.
It's kind of like when news breaks and mm-hmm. you look at 10 different sources yeah. and they all say, according to the Associated Press, and then continue to quote the same information.
Yeah. It's basically that guy, I forgot his name, but I posted it on Facebook. I'm like, it's the same article. I lost count of how many times they used the word claims and allegedly mm-hmm. in the article talking about this guy and what he is claiming and what evidence he allegedly has. So don't always click the article first. The headlines are clickbait.
Oh, so much so. Oh my God, you guys.
Just be aware. It's not, there's no new groundbreaking information in that case. There's none.
FYI.
Also, basing all of your knowledge off of headlines,
please
anyway,
stop.
Fucking stop it.
Don't do that.
Read the information.
Yeah.
And speaking of articles and that we've been sent,
yes?
And me specifically, several times, which thank you, because at first I was like, I don't know about this, since we had that incident in 2020. When they were like, there's a serial killer in Portland.
Yeah.
I was going to bring it up. And I was like,
no, I don't think that's right. This time, though, there are names. And
there's
actually evidence. So this is from an Oregon Live article by Catalina Gaitan. 6 women, most with connections to the greater Portland area and all under the age of 40, have been found dead within 100 miles of each other the past 3 months, most in wooded or secluded rural areas. It is unclear what, if anything, connects the women's deaths and disappearances, which are being investigated by the Portland Police Bureau with sheriff's offices in Multnomah, Polk, Clark, and Clackamas counties.
Yep.
Great, because there's 5 detectives that work there right now. So,
and the victims, we know of so far are Kristen Smith, 22. Her body was discovered in the Pleasant Valley neighborhood on February 19th. Joanna Speaks, 32. Her body was discovered in a barn in Ridgefield, Washington on April 8th. Charity Lynn Perry, 24. Her body was discovered in a culvert near Ainsworth State Park in East Multnomah County on April 24th. The body of an unidentified woman was found near Southeast Flavelle and I-205 in the Lentz neighborhood.
Oh my God.
Yeah, on April 24th. The same day as and 3 miles from the body of Charity Lynn Perry. According to the Oregon Live article, the Multnomah County Medical Examiner's Office is seeking the public's help in identifying the woman who was possibly Native American or Native Alaskan between the ages of 25 and 40, county officials said. She had black medium-length hair, was just over 5 feet tall, weighed 135 pounds, and had 2 large scars on her left lower leg. Officials say the woman had 2 noticeable tattoos, a black music note with the letter V on the left side of her upper chest, and a depiction of Buddha on her right upper back. The woman was found wearing rings and bracelets, a green long sleeve shirt, a black and white zip-up jacket, jeans, and black and white Adidas cleats.
I realized that it was a depiction,
mm-hmm.
and I'm assuming it's because, I mean, there are no photos of her because they don't know who she is,
yeah.
and she was probably not in the best shape, but even then, she looks Laos or Thai to me, and that tattoo makes sense.
The Buddha. Entirely possible. Next was Bridget Leanne Ramsey Webster, 31. Her body was discovered near Mill Creek on Harmony Road, just south of Sheridan, Oregon, on April 30th. And Ashley Rial, 22, her body was discovered in a wooded area near the Eagle Creek area on May 7th. And as of now, the cause of death has only been released for Joanna Speaks, as far as I know. And according to the Oregon Live article, the county medical examiner determined Speaks died of blunt head and neck injuries. The Clark County Sheriff's Office is investigating the death as a homicide and said Speaks' body was moved to the location where it was found.
Do they all have the same cause of death in common?
Don't they know. Only released the one.
They only released that one. Okay. The one in Ridgefield, I believe, is the only one so far that I am aware of. There could have been an update. But so far, that's the only one that I am aware of when I wrote that. So we will be watching and keeping everyone updated. Hopefully, I don't know if it's one person because I, again, have no idea. No.
And the question is, are they connected?
Exactly. So
hard to say. They're not centrally located. They're centrally located enough to be in the vicinity of the Portland metro area.
Yeah.
But they are so spread out.
Yeah.
It could coincidentally be a thing.
Yeah,
or
because Washington,
I mean,
like Ridgefield, Ridgefield, Washington is about 45 minutes from my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So it's not, and then Vancouver, Washington is about 30 minutes, depending on traffic. So it's not
fucking
like it's super.
Lentz is like 4 minutes.
I know.
That's close.
Yeah, yeah, the first victim that
it's
was
like
found.
Down the street from where John works.
Yeah, she was. Exactly.
Yeah.
The one found on, let's see, Kristen Smith, the first victim that was discovered. The area she was found in, I drive by there all the time when I go get my nails done.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I know exactly where it's at. It's very weird and very surreal. So hopefully we get answers soon and we find out who the unidentified woman is.
Mm-hmm. And, well, and it's hard to say if, because they're not releasing a whole lot. I mean, were any of these women on the streets? Were any of these, did any of them have tied to drugs? Did
as
any
far
of them,
as I know from the article that I read.
Were any of them reported missing?
Yes.
Right.
So for, I just did like a basic rundown. Go read that article on Oregon Live because it has way more information than I provided because we would have been here for an eternity. And since it's developing, I didn't want to put too much in there in case anything changed.
Yeah.
But that article is a really thorough and detailed one. So go read that again. It was an Oregon Live article by Catalina Gaitan. And yeah, so we will keep everybody updated as we get more information. But hopefully they figure it all out soon.
Also, according to PPB, they have no reason to believe that the six cases are connected.
Yeah. As of now, there's
no, evidence to believe that
there's no evidence.
Anti-serial.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It makes for a good headline.
Yeah. It does make for a very good headline.
As of now, there is no actual proof that it is a serial killer, and I don't think they're treating the investigations as such.
And they haven't found a connection yet. It could just be
that it just
random coincidence, or who knows. But we will eventually. So
either way,
we'll keep an eye on it.
Be safe,
please.
Have a friend walk you to your car.
We'll keep an eye on it.
And I get a good thing. I rarely leave my house because that one is like right up the street.
Yeah.
Right up the street. Like,
that's scary.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It sure is. But in more, I mean, less horrifying news, I brought some snacks.
Snacks. All right, so between the cupcakes and these, my dinner's set.
Hell done. Yeah. I mean, we'll see if there's any of these you want to keep.
Okay.
Oh boy.
I mean, they're not bad. They're not bad.
So you say.
Ketchup lobster chips or something.
Gross.
I don't buy the fish-flavored ones because I know she won't eat them.
It's true. It's
so, terrible. I mean, terrible. I probably would.
It's terrible choices.
But do you want, I've got three littles and one big bag. What do you want to start with?
Go big or go home.
Okay.
Ooh, Sun Chips.
Yeah, they're Sun Chips.
I fucking love Sun Chips.
I do too.
There's no hiding what it is because it's right there. It's garlic baguette flavored Sun Chips.
What a random.
I am going, that bag will be finished by me.
It's like a garlic bread flavored Sun Chip?
Yeah.
I might need an adult. This bag is like.
I have scissors behind me.
Ooh. This bag is like.
But throwing the bag will be a lot less dangerous than throwing
scissors. It's true. Oh, there we go. She got it.
Okay. At first, it smelled a little farty. but
most garlic.
Most chips do when you open them, though.
It's like, also it's garlic. It's gonna smell like farts. Yeah.
Plain Lay's smells like fart. Oh, yeah, the
there's
second
some farts in there.
Yeah. At first, it was like a hint of fart, and then garlic
it's an
bread.
Interesting smell. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah. I'm not gonna do it yet. I'm just sniffing.
We got an ASMR together. Oh, I'm gonna love this. I know it. It's like my favorite chip and one of my favorite.
I do love Sun Chips.
All right. Here we go.
Ooh.
I love that. I love that.
Those are real good.
Those are fucking delicious.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
God damn.
Yeah.
If you see those, get them.
Get them. Get like 30 of them.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Have I done that with the hot mustard chips?
I was really hoping you guys would hate these.
Well, there's three more bags in here, so you can... Mm. And I go to my local Asian supermarket frequently,
which is
where I found these, because I'm...
Wow.
I'm not concerned. You can...
I can tell from the back.
You can have at it. Touché.
And then...
Let's see. There's blue, green, or tri-colored.
You choose this time.
Three?
Tri-colored.
Okay. This one. I think I sent you a picture of this. This is Lay's 3-in-1.
3-in-1 what?
So it's kind of, what's the Chicago-style popcorn or something where it's the three different kinds of popcorn?
Oh, it's like cheese, caramel, and regular?
But in a chip.
The fuck?
I know. I was like, I have many questions.
You know what I had recently?
What?
Someone brought caramel-covered cheese popcorn into work.
Yeah. Yes. Yum.
It was fucking delicious. It was so good.
Yes.
I don't
care for it.
Ooh. Okay, we are... Oh, wait. I'm suspicious of the smell.
We are indeed suspicious of the smell. Uh-huh. I'm just trying to see if all of those flavors are in one chip or if it's different chips. But they all look the same. So I don't know what's happening here. They do!
All right, well, we're going to fucking figure it out, I guess.
I'm going to take more than one in case there's different flavors on chips, but they look... This one looks like it might be caramel.
I think it's the 3-in-1 on one chip.
I feel like it would be really dumb for them to...
That would be...
Maybe not.
...separate chips in a bag.
That's a weird smell.
But see, this one is more brown. So I think that one might be caramel flavored.
Mm, I think it's like, you know when you get the Dorito that's darker... orange than the rest of them?
No, that one's definitely caramel flavored.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm.
No, that's very caramely.
They all taste the same.
Yeah. That's what happens when you put them all in the same bag. I think that one I had was butter.
Yeah.
I'm not mad about sweet chips.
No.
I don't hate them. But would I get them again?
No.
Probably not. I'd rather get that tin of popcorn.
Mm-hmm. Because then you know what you're getting.
Yeah. The caramel one tastes a little too much like coffee for me.
I'll finish them.
Go for it. Okay. Now we've got...
You're having chips for dinner.
Now we've got...
I pay for it.
Green and blue.
Hmm?
Blue.
Okay.
Shrimp.
It's shrimp. Not. Do you want to know what it is or do you want to guess? I don't think you'd guess.
Then tell me. I don't know.
Gatorade.
Dear God, no.
Wow. That'd be weird.
These are Lay's Magic Masala.
Oh.
Flavor. Yeah.
I'm here for it.
Right?
That sounds fun.
I know. I was like, okay. So.
Bag's giving you a fit today.
They
are. Way ASMR today.
This, like,
giving you
pressurized for an airplane? What's happening? This one won't.
Toss it.
That one just refused. Because I have.
Oh, yeah, no.
Okay, so it's not just me.
No, it's not.
Good to know.
He even manhanded it.
You sure did.
And it was like, nah, bitch.
Yeah. It's like, you're not on an airplane. Don't open me right now. I'll explode.
It did. Okay. Snacks.
Mmm.
Okay. It smells exactly what it's advertised.
Yeah. Doesn't smell like much of anything,
there
but.
Yeah.
Ooh, oniony.
like that.
I do too.
That's the one I would buy again.
It's a little weird on the front end, but yeah, it's good.
Yeah, there's a kick on the front end.
No, you bite into it, and all I taste was like biting into an onion, which mm-hmm. I wouldn't do, but I don't hate it.
I don't hate it as a chip.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Also, for some reason,
oh my God,
it kind of has like an hard-boiled egg aftertaste.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's what I was catching on the front end.
Maybe.
And on the back end. There's something weird on the front end.
On the front butt.
On the front. The front butt had something weird.
Onions on the front butt.
Yeah. All right, last but not least.
Episode title. That's a potential one.
Yeah, it sure is.
Onions on the front butt.
I'm
going
to write it down.
Absolutely.
And then this one I feel like you could guess.
And then there was one.
It's not.
I feel like that one's going to be hard to open, too.
Probably. I think it's maybe partly because there's a paper sticker on the back of it that...
Oh, for the import shit?
Yeah. Keeps me from getting a good grip.
Ooh! There you go. Mm. Ooh.
What is?
That's a face.
Sweet basil.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Like a pesto chip.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's got, the smell is weird.
There's a smell, it's a familiar smell.
Yeah.
That's not basil.
Yeah.
Grab on, let me see if I can suss this out.
Almost like a weird cologne smell. Toothpaste?
No, that's, hang on. I know exactly what this is, hang on.
Right?
Fuck. I know the smell.
We'll figure it out.
It also tastes like something else. Is it like the sour cream and onion, the cheesy sour cream and onion one?
No. Fuck. What does this smell like? Oh, let's taste it.
It tastes like the cheesy sour cream and onion.
Oh, it tastes like sweet basil.
Does it?
Mm-hmm. Sour cream and onion chips aren't sweet.
See, I love basil, and I don't like... This doesn't taste basil-y to me.
Yeah, I don't... Maybe my mouth is broken from the masala chip. But is that one spicy?
No.
Okay, then my mouth is still on fire from the masala
chip. Oh, I thought it was spicy. No?
No.
Not
oh,
at all.
Got it. No. I'm still on fire, too. Bueno. Well, shit, fuck fire and hell.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
There's some pretty good ones in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the best ones, garlic bread, number one.
Yep.
Masala chip, number two.
Uh-huh. Basil, three. I'm going basil, three, because the sweet ones were, they were fun. I would buy this again, like, if it was between this and shrimp chips.
Yeah.
I'd get this.
Yeah.
But if it was between shrimp chips and sweet chips, I might go neither.
Fair. I can't decide. I think the... Basil and the sweet ones are tied for me at number three.
Same. Well, look at us. Well, all right. So that's it for the backhoes then?
It is.
Well, I go first then,
yes? Yes, you do.
Well, I bet y'all are glad I'm going first.
Oh, we're recording. Good.
Great. I love that for us. With the cliffhanger that I so rudely left you all on to the point that I actually got texts. Wait, I've got a way. My sister texted me. She's like, I got a 2-hour drive to Florida, and now I have to wait another week to find out what happens to Tiffany. Well, the wait is over, everyone. The wait is over. So, if you are somehow just picking up here and you've never listened, go back and listen last week because this is a part two. This is a two-parter.
Yes, it is.
So if you guys will remember, Tiffany was hit by the train, her parents distraught, went to the lawyer because some shit wasn't adding up. Lawyer's like, you know what? I'm going to subpoena these records and I'm really going to give these people some closure because their daughter obviously committed suicide. And then as he dug, he was like, I don't believe she did.
Yeah. Which, no.
So here we go. Part two of the story of Tiffany Valiente. So... It turns out that a lot of what the New Jersey Transit Police Department did was just flat out bungled, and much of the evidence collected had been improperly stored and became contaminated, including the shirt that they did find that Tiffany had been wearing. Well, apparently New Jersey Transit, had this shirt. They also recovered an axe that was noted as having red marks, quote, in quotations, from the scene, which they somehow lost.
Oh, that's convenient.
So they found an axe.
For no one.
With red marks. Mm. Not even, no specification. And they lost it. So D'Amato reviewed what was known about that night. And that was that New Jersey Transit train 4693 left Philadelphia at 9:50 p.m., headed east to Absecon Station in Atlantic City with about 60 passengers and crew on board. At 11:12 p.m., the train passed under the bridge at Tilton Road in Galloway Township and headed toward the crossing at Genoa Avenue. At 11:15 p.m., on a dark stretch of track near Prague Avenue and mile marker 45, Tiffany was hit by the train. It dragged her body about a quarter mile before being able to come to a full and complete stop. So the incident occurred about an hour and a half after she was last seen. When the train was examined later, it showed that the impact occurred on the lower left side, close to the track. So down low.
Yeah.
Two engineers were on board, a senior engineer, Wayne Daniels, and a student engineer, Marvin Olivares. So Olivares was at the controls and had been on the job for about a year. That night, they both signed a report saying that Tiffany dove in front of the train. So Daniels told investigators that he instructed Olivares to blow the horn and ring the bell as he put on the emergency brake.
Mm-hmm.
But Wayne Daniels told a completely different story when he was put under oath 6 days later.
Oh, no.
He then said that he was talking to the conductor when she was hit and that he hadn't seen anything because his back was turned. However, he did say that Olivares blew the horn, put on the emergency brake, and then told him a girl jumped out in front of us. So D'Amato also found inconsistencies in Marvin Olivares' testimony. Initially, when he was asked, "When did you first see Tiffany?" he said, "I didn't see her until I was right on top of her." But 10 days later, when he was put under oath, he stated that he stated that he saw her crouched next to the tracks when he was half a mile and a quarter of a mile away. So he saw her at half a mile, saw her at quarter mile, mm-hmm. and she was still just crouching next to the tracks. He said that he saw her stand up and dive in front of the train, but then in another interview, he said that Tiffany darted out from the woods and ran onto the tracks right before she was hit. And D'Amato stated that the New Jersey Transit Police Department stood by Olivares' inconsistent statements, and which was how they ruled the incident a suicide. But Louise Hausman, a retired medical examiner from the Atlantic County Medical Examiner's Office, examined Tiffany's case. And she was concerned by the sworn statements from Daniels and Olivares and noted that a great deal of weight was given to the information they provided. Information that turned out to not be correct because the train was equipped with what's called a major incident event recorder, which is exactly what the fuck it sounds like. So it records several parameters, including the train's speed when the handbrakes and horn are used. It also gives the distance the train has traveled during an event. And according to the recorder, in 4.1 seconds, Olivares sounded the horn, hit Tiffany, and applied the emergency brake at 80 miles an hour.
Oof.
Examiner Hausman questioned whether Olivares would have been able to see Tiffany jump in front of the train in that time frame. We're talking 4.1 seconds where he supposedly saw her hit the horn and the brakes. 4.1 seconds.
That's a lot of stuff to happen in that period of time.
So first it was she darted out from the woods, mm-hmm. and then she was standing next to the track, stood up and jumped under the train.
Yeah.
Which is it? Yes. I see you once. Yes. Yes.
He saw her at half mile and a quarter mile or full mile and a quarter mile?
He saw her at half mile, quarter mile. She was crouched next to the tracks when he was a half mile away and when he was a quarter mile away.
Okay.
Then he saw her stand up and dive in front of the train.
Right. Okay. Hang on.
So she's darted out in one. She's dove under one.
Saw her at
and she jumped in front of in one.
That would mean that in 4 seconds, if he saw her at a half a mile, that means, okay, so that's 1 mile per 8 seconds. So
we're doing math.
Oh, yeah.
All you.
Mm-hmm. So now, mind you, he was going 80 miles an hour.
This feels like one of the most horrifying math problems.
Right?
So, okay. That's a...
Yeah.
He's completely full of shit.
Yeah.
Because a mile every 8 seconds would mean, I believe, and you guys can check me on this, that he was going 800 miles an hour.
Well,
I'll never be able to do that for you.
So
somebody else do that math.
Yeah. So the recorder said in 4.1 seconds, he sounded the horn, hit Tiffany, and then applied the emergency brakes at 80.
Right. And logic would dictate that a train conductor would probably sound the horn and start braking at the half mile mark.
Yeah.
When you see a girl crouch next to the tracks.
You fucking stop the train the second you
exactly.
see that.
You're correct. You're like, nope. Either as a warning or you pull the brake just in case.
Yeah. Because
that'll give you, you know, way more time to stop than when you see them allegedly dive onto the track. That by that point, it's too late to stop the train.
I gotta figure out this math.
Right. So Examiner Hausman questioned whether Olivares would have even been able to see Tiffany jump in front of the train in that time frame.
Yeah.
Mind you, you're up high. If she's crouched down to the tracks, this all happened in 4.1 seconds. How did you see her dive in front of the train when you've already hit her?
Yeah. Exactly.
I may be wrong. 439 miles an hour.
Still.
It's not 80.
It's not 80. That, like, in order for his story to check out, or in order for, yeah, in order for his testimony to match that timeline,
mm-hmm.
he would have had to have been going 440 miles an hour.
Yep. And both he and Daniels changed their story under oath. So she believes that Olivares was rightfully in shock after the train hit Tiffany, which made it more difficult for him to clearly remember and describe what exactly had happened in this 4.1 seconds, which fair. She also believes that his statements kept changing because he really didn't know what the hell had happened, and that seeing Tiffany's body parts flying in all different directions because she was being dismembered, not because she was jumping in front of the train. So when the train hit her, her body parts apparently flew. So how could he have seen which direction she came from, number one? How did you see her dive under the train? You didn't see her dive under the train. You didn't see her dart out from the woods. Like, which is it?
Yeah.
He could have seen her darting out from the woods from a quarter mile away. He could have seen her crouching next to the tracks at a quarter mile away. But in that, at that point, would you have not already hit the horn?
Yeah.
Right. So, but he hit the horn, hit her, and the brakes 4.1 seconds. So, in fact, so Examiner Hausman suspects that Tiffany actually may have been dead on the tracks before she was hit.
That was what I was thinking.
Mm-hmm. So now how badly bungled was this investigation and why? Well, I'll tell you. For starters, none of Tiffany's clothing was ever sent out for DNA testing.
That's not great.
And 5 years, 5 years after her death, her family won a court order and paid to have the items tested. But they couldn't because Tiffany's shirt had been put into a plastic bag, tied into a knot, and it molded.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Then other key items were just left outdoors and exposed to all manner of elements, making them contaminated as well. And then the blood card containing Tiffany's DNA, so, you know, they, so, was so mishandled that analysts reevaluating it couldn't even be sure it was hers without testing her parents' DNA against it.
Jesus.
According to D'Amato, there was also not just a missing axe that was found near the scene, but there's also a knife and a bloody towel. Blood belonging to an unknown male that couldn't be tested either because it was contaminated. So an unidentified male DNA profile was found on another piece of evidence. Not sure what, but they can't be sure if it belonged to a suspect or someone involved in the investigation, because literally no one was treating Tiffany's death as a potential homicide, which is protocol. You have to rule out homicide, even in a suspected suicide.
Yeah.
You have to treat it like a homicide until you prove otherwise. They were treating it like a suicide. They did nothing to treat this like a homicide. They contaminated evidence all over the fucking place. So Diane's theory is that her daughter got into a car that night with someone she knew, and that once Tiffany got into the vehicle, her phone was taken and thrown out the window as they drove away, which is why it was in the road at the end of their driveway. Diane theorizes that her abductors had tried to rape her, or potentially had raped her, which is why she was found wearing only her bra and panties. According to D'Amato, the crime scene photographs show what appeared to be a large pool of blood at the point where the train hit Tiffany, which suggests to him that she was already lying there bleeding before she was hit.
Ew.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if she had been alive and jumped under that train, when that train hit her at 80 miles an hour and her limbs flew off, there'd be more spatter than anything. And then the blood, she was drug, right? And then the blood would pool where they eventually stopped. If she was moving at 80 miles an hour, slowing down,
right,
when he hit the brakes, you know, 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, the blood would pool where she stopped, right?
It depends.
Because if you're being hit at 80 miles an hour and that train is now carrying you.
Right, but I think there's a bit of a disconnect over how much trauma a human body can take at 80 miles an hour versus a train.
Hard to say.
The body would have to be fairly intact to pool that much blood where she stopped.
Which it was not intact.
Right. So what he's saying is at the spot a quarter mile at mile marker 45 where he hit her. And it was recorded, there was a big pool of blood there.
Oh, yeah, she was already dead.
That's exactly what they're saying.
There
was a pool of blood at the point of impact.
Or, like, severely injured.
Right.
But she was left there, specifically, yeah. Right. For sure. She wasn't pushed, she was left there.
Right. So, according to him, the police did not test the blood because they claimed that they had enough evidence to conclude it was a suicide, so it was never determined if that was Tiffany's blood on the tracks.
That just makes me want to
So there's a giant fucking pool of blood. They didn't even test it to see if it was hers.
That makes me want to physically fight every person didn't test it at all. That made that decision.
You know what this makes me feel like?
Yep.
A whole ass car.
A whole ass fucking car. Yep.
Like, even if you suspected it was a suicide, why would you not take samples anyway just in case?
So now the New Jersey Transit Medical Examiner's report says that Tiffany's arms and legs were cut from her torso. And D'Amato believes that she was dismembered before her body was placed on the tracks.
I don't love it.
And he believes that she was laid across the tracks with her arms off to one side and her legs off to the other. The fact that Tiffany's feet and hands were intact indicates she was not standing on the tracks when she was hit by the train.
Yeah.
So one whole leg, one whole arm, one whole leg, one whole arm. Yeah. No fingers missing. It wasn't like she would just, everything was in one, like, four pieces.
Yeah.
Solid pieces.
And again, the fact that the bottoms of her feet.
Pristinely clean.
Yeah. And unfortunately, when I was looking for pictures for last week's episode, that there's a picture of the bottoms of her feet posted from her autopsy. And I was like, oh, surprise. Oh, no. I mean, it's not like a gory photo. Right. If you don't know what you're looking at, you're just like, oh, it's someone's foot. But no. I knew. And I was like, oh, son of a bitch. And it looked like there was like maybe some grass or something on it, but nothing like walking 2 miles through the woods.
And the dirt. And the rocks on the tracks.
Sharp rocks and then onto the tracks, which are never smooth.
Yeah. And they have the tarry stuff.
Yeah.
And
they were way too clean for what they're trying to say happened before the train hit her.
I walk barefoot from my house to my car and I have dirty feet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's like there's no way. There's just no way.
Right.
For that to have been a thing.
But see, now the interesting thing too is in the New Jersey Transit Medical Examiner's report, says cut from the torso. There's no specification. It's not torn. The mm-hmm. words cut were used.
Yeah.
So, now, because of this total clusterfuck, D'Amato asked private investigator Chuck Atkinson to help work on Tiffany's case. And he had worked for the New Jersey State Police for 26 years, and he was a detective for 17 of them. Following Tiffany's death, D'Amato and her family set up a hotline, hoping for anonymous tips from the public. And in November of 2016, they received a call from a Wawa store manager who had overheard three of his teenage employees discussing Tiffany's case. And he said that he had also gone to the police with this information. He said that he had overheard them saying that Tiffany had been murdered. According to the manager, when he asked the teens what they were talking about, they said that they didn't have any firsthand knowledge, but they were just telling him what talking about what they had heard. Yeah. And one of them claimed to have seen Tiffany at the graduation party that night, and they talked about the argument between Tiffany and her friend about the stolen debit card and that Tiffany had left right after, which is correct. They said that the friend was still mad about her card being stolen and that she had called someone who came by, picked her up in a truck with an unidentified guy, then went and picked up Tiffany. And according to the teens, they took Tiffany to an area near the train tracks, stripped her naked, held her at gunpoint just to humiliate her. Mm. The police did interview the teens about after the manager originally called, but they all denied saying anything about Tiffany's death, and the police also noted that the manager's information was third-hand and full of holes. So, now, why would the transit police be so quick to rule Tiffany's death a suicide and not even entertain any other option or follow investigation protocol for that matter? Because protocol is you treat it like a fucking homicide until it's proven otherwise.
Yeah.
And how did they fuck up so much evidence? Well, first and foremost, transit police generally don't deal with homicides or suspicious death investigations. So then there's liability. D'Amato thinks that the transit police wanted to rule Tiffany's death a suicide because it gets them off the hook, essentially. Because a death on the tracks due to negligence can cause increased oversight, hefty fines, and possible criminal charges. So he believes that investigators treated her death just like a suicide from the get-go, so this affected how the scene was processed by the responding police and medical examiner staff. They're like, oh yeah, we've got a suicide. We've got a suicide. We've got a suicide. And everybody's like, oh, okay, well, it's a suicide. We don't need to take any other precautions.
Yeah.
You know, just put that shirt in here and tie it up. Let it mold. You know, no big deal.
It's basically the transit police's version of drawing a false confession.
So, yeah. So, this is also why a complete autopsy was never done. Neither was a rape kit. DNA was never tested, and none of her organs were examined. A toxicology report was done, however, and it showed that there was no alcohol or drugs in her system. And according to Examiner Hausman, a detective wrote in his report that Tiffany's shoes were not found with her body or at the scene, which, in Diane's statement, Tiffany had been wearing the headband, the shorts, a shirt, and shoes when she was seen on the deer cam. But when they found her body, all she had on was the sports bra and underwear. So why did the attending medical examiner not think this was odd?
Yeah.
Or even try to figure out what had happened to Tiffany's clothing? You just said in the report, oh, she was wearing no clothes. Okay, but why? You don't want to look for them? You don't want to put in your report, had officers look at, like, nothing? Nothing.
Yeah, that's really weird. Right.
Hausman notes that the medical examiner's report was short and sweet, basically just noting that Tiffany's limbs were ripped from her torso and that her face and head were completely crushed. It listed her cause of death as multiple traumatic injuries. Hausman found no evidence that the medical examiner had reviewed any of Tiffany's medical records or contacted Tiffany's doctor. Diane and other family members claim that no one ever questioned them about the case, and her cousin Robert Jr. believes they just ruled it a suicide because she had been hit on the tracks at the end.
Yeah.
Hausman criticized the police for not conducting a psychological autopsy, which could indicate whether or not Tiffany was at risk for suicide, which a pathologist will usually do before a suicide ruling can be made. They must determine why the victim did it. However, in Tiffany's case, no clear motive for suicide was ever identified. They didn't talk to doctors. They didn't, hey, was she being treated for depression? Hey.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Bang up work, gentlemen.
Yep. Yeah. So now, some of Tiffany's friends think that suicide could have been a possibility and that maybe getting caught stealing her friend's card was the last straw. When Tiffany came out in early 2015, 6 months before her death, Diane told her that she was just going through a phase. Oof. However, Diane and Stephen claim that they did accept Tiffany's sexuality, but some classmates told investigators that she may have been having a tougher time with her sexuality than she let on. Within herself. Mm-hmm. One classmate claimed that Tiffany had been acting differently in the months before she died, saying that she had been feeling distant from her parents and she was lonely. According to D'Amato, some people who knew Tiffany said that she was sad and depressed. One of Tiffany's close friends said that she was popular, well-liked, and appeared happy to most people, but that Tiffany put on a brave face and hid her sadness well. She believes Tiffany felt like she could never fit in and said that Tiffany could also be impulsive and have a hot temper. But she did follow with the fact that Tiffany never spoke of suicide to her. Mm-hmm. A few of Tiffany's friends told investigators that Tiffany did engage in some self-harm a few times, cutting her wrist and leg. Now, Tiffany did have a girlfriend that lived in Philadelphia. And according to Diane, they had broken up the Friday before her death, but that it was mutual. And based on the phone records that examiner Hausman read, there didn't seem to be any hostility between the two. In fact, according to the records, Tiffany had started another relationship with a woman she had met online. And according to Diane, the night before Tiffany died, she had posted on social media, "I'm kind of content right now." So, needless to say, there are many questions regarding the death of Tiffany Valiente that are unanswered. How did she get from her house to the spot where she was hit by the train? Did she walk? Did someone pick her up and drive her there? Because remember, there's 1 minute. 1 minute span between the time Tiffany's photo was taken on the deer cam and her parents' photo was taken on that deer cam. Mm-hmm. 1 minute, 60 fucking seconds on a straight shot road, and they didn't see her.
Yeah. And again,
she had to have gotten into a car with someone.
She was like 6'2", 6'3".
She was 6'2".
And she had on a bright white headband.
Yep.
And wasn't she wearing, she had white shoes.
White shorts.
And white
shorts. Yeah, and white shoes. Yeah.
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 Like, in the night,
yeah,
you're with 60 seconds.
And it's 9 o'clock in the summer. It's not that dark.
No. Even if it were, mm-hmm, I feel like you'd still be able, with 60 seconds between you.
60 seconds.
And a straight shot, you should have been able to see someone if they were walking. Even if she's 6'2", she with
right
a stride.
Or left in 60 seconds, you would have seen her 60 seconds ahead of you.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Because it's not like there's a lot of stuff obstructing your view. Nope. From
straight,
where they were going.
It's a straight shot.
Yeah.
So, was her death an accident, suicide, or murder? Valiente's attorney, Paul D'Amato, believes that there are people out there who know what happened to her, and he asks that they come forward and help Tiffany's family. After her death, the Valiente family erected a small memorial near the spot where Tiffany died. And before she went to college, Stephen promised to build her a volleyball court. And after she died, he built it. He also set up a memorial garden in their backyard and put several stone giraffes and turtles around it, which were her favorite animals. He says that Tiffany couldn't wait to go to college and play volleyball. And he wholeheartedly believes that someone robbed her of that and all of her future dreams, for that matter. Stephen wants justice for his daughter. He says he struggles to wake up and go to sleep each day, but that he will until he finds out what happened to her. Diane has a cabinet in the home that she's filled with memories of Tiffany, and friends and relatives have all brought items that remind them of Tiffany to put in the cabinet. One of the items is the bracelet that she was wearing when she died that Robert found, and the cabinet also contains Tiffany's ashes. Diane also has a prayer box she keeps in the cabinet that she uses to pray with every night, and the inscription inside says, for justice for Tiffany, and hope that the people that did this to her will come forward. The Valiente's plan and wish is to get the state of New Jersey to change the manner of their daughter's death from suicide to undetermined, mm-hmm, and to hopefully identify the person or persons who they believe killed Tiffany and left her on the tracks. They have filed lawsuits against several unnamed defendants, alleging their involvement in Tiffany's alleged kidnapping, assault, and murder, and a $40,000 reward is still being offered for any information on this case. And that is the case of the mysterious death of Tiffany Valiente.
So,
yeah. My sources are All That's Interesting, Kalina Fraga, Unilad.com, Gabriella Ferlita, ScreenRant.com, Matt Morrison, and UnsolvedMysteries.fandom.motherfucking.com.
Yes, my favorite.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. It's just, there's, even if it were a suicide.
Right.
It shouldn't have been treated that way.
No. That's not how that works.
No.
That's not how that works.
If anything, just, you know.
You know, they left.
Undetermined.
They left all kinds of bloody gloves on the tracks. And it's like, oh, yeah, no, she's got no clothes. That's weird. This is, no. No, no, no. Well, why doesn't she have clothes? Where's her clothes? Are you looking for her clothes?
Yeah.
No.
Like, why is there an axe? Is it related? We should look into that.
Where's the knife? And the bloody towel with the unidentified male's DNA. Where'd that go? Oh, you lost that too? Weird. Huh.
Questions.
Huh.
Several.
And, you couldn't test it contaminated? Weird.
Yeah.
Okay. And why were her shoes and headband found?
What was it, like a mile?
Way far from, the bloodhound didn't even pick up on it. Walked right fucking past it.
Yeah. Because wasn't that stuff was found closer to her house than the train track, I think.
It was 2 miles. Yeah, it was a mile from the house and 2 from the train track.
Yeah, like from the little map I posted.
Mm-hmm. And her shorts have never been found. Ever.
I really hate
ever.
That.
They found the shirt.
Yeah.
But, you know, just tied it in a knot, let it mold. Okay. Don't need to check DNA there. Don't need to check nothing.
Just... Dude,
so how did the bloodhound, who is tracking her scent, walk right past where her shoes and headband were?
Yeah, that's not...
Right.
That's, again, too many questions.
Unless someone could have put it there later. But, I mean, Diane's theory kind of fits. Her phone at the end of the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Just right there on the side of the road.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was only 60 seconds ahead of them. 60 seconds.
Yeah.
If she was still walking on that road, they could have looked left or right and they would have fucking seen her.
Yeah.
You don't go a mile in 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
They would have seen her. Where the fuck did she go? Unless she got into a car.
Yeah. Which, and since her phone was right there, mm-hmm. I'm assuming they looked through it, didn't find anything.
Nope.
No text to anybody saying, hey, come pick me up. Mm-hmm. I got in whatever, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So...
But, you know, again, too, after, so there's the teens were saying, oh, yeah, the girl had someone go and another woman and a guy went and picked her up, blah, blah, blah. But if you'll remember, Diane called that friend and said Tiffany's missing. That friend came back.
Mm-hmm.
And that friend was helping look for Tiffany.
Yeah.
So, hard to say. Somebody picked her up. That's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that makes sense. Unless she was hiding in the woods. I mean, maybe not. Who knows? Hard to say.
I have too many questions.
So many questions.
Too many questions.
All of the questions.
But I also have a story.
Oh, yes.
And since every season is spoopy season in our hearts, I decided we need another ghostly-ish tale. So on this day, I'm going to tell you about the Turley family and the murder of Ernest Turley.
Ernest Turley.
Yeah.
Goodness, goodness.
Buckle up, it's weird.
Oh, boy.
November 1933.
Okay.
Dorothea Turley and her son David left their White Mountain Ranch, which is near Springerville, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to the grocery store to buy ingredients for David's special birthday dinner. The night before, a skunk had chased the family cat under the house, so Dorothea suggested that Maddie, the Turley's 15-year-old daughter, stay at the house to help her father Ernest get rid of the stinky little pest. Mm-hmm. I guess the fighting and the noise and the smell the night before was so bad that nobody could sleep.
Yeah.
So they were all pretty fucking annoyed at this skunk under their house. According to one source, Maddie responded to her mother's suggestion with, I won't help catch him, but I might shoot. As she shouldered her loaded rifle and ate an apple. Did it really happen like that? Hard to say. Could have been some colorful commentary added by the author of the article, but it does sound cool as hell. So, anyway, Dorothea and David made their way to the store while Ernest and Maddie tended to some chores around the property before taking care of the skunk under the house. Eventually, you know, did whatever little things they needed to do, and then Ernest went to milk the family's new cow. Maddie followed along, toting her gun the whole time, and once the cow was milked, Ernest started to make his way back to the house, with Maddie bringing up the rear. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, two shots rang out, and Ernest hit the ground.
Oh, shit.
He rolled over to see Maddie on her knees next to her smoking gun. Obviously shaken, the teen yelled out to her father to see if he was okay and ran to his side. Ernest, who'd just been shot in the back and hip area twice, told her through the pain, "You should be more careful. Let this be a lesson to you." It was obviously an accident, but still an emergency, so Ernest urged Maddie to go get help as fast as she could.
Oh, shit.
On her way out, she ran into her mother and brother, who were just returning from their trip into town, and explained that she'd tripped and accidentally shot Ernest. A few hours later, the doctor arrived, and while things weren't great, obviously, mm-hmm. It seemed that Ernest would go on to recover from his injuries.
Okay.
So, we all know from what I just said that that doesn't last. But for now, he seems to be doing just fine, okay, all things considered. Dorothea tended to her husband through the night and was assisted by a neighbor named Kent Pierce. Over the next day or so, neighbors would come to check on the family, and since Maddie was understandably hysterical, you know, just having shot her father and all, mm-hmm. Everyone made sure to be extra gentle with her. As was customary, the local police stopped by the Turley home to ask some questions. Just, you know,
right,
procedure. Everything seemed pretty straightforward until one officer noted that the trajectory of the bullets fired into Ernest's body didn't match up to Maddie's story. If she'd fallen and the gun had gone off, the bullets would have hit her father from an upwards direction.
Right.
However, Ernest's injury showed a downward trajectory, as if someone had aimed the gun from about shoulder height before pulling the trigger. When the officer brought this up, Maddie immediately confessed that she'd shot her father intentionally and revealed that, shockingly, a Ouija board had told her to do it.
Oh, Jesus, fuck me, Christ. Okay.
Now, before we get too far into the rest of the story, let's go back in time a ways and get to know the Turleys. Surprisingly, said sarcastically, there's not a whole lot of information out there on their pasts. But out of all the family members, the most information available prior to the tragedy is about Dorothea. So, here we go. Mm-hmm. Dorothea Irene Kalanick was born in Cornwall, England in 1895. And the following year, her family took a ship across the sea and immigrated to New York. She would go on to study around the world at colleges in Dublin, Berlin, Paris, Leipzig, before eventually studying at the London Academy of Music to pursue her dream of becoming an actress and performer. Mm-hmm. When she was 21 years old, Dorothea, who was at the time working as a singer in New York, she entered the Miss American Venus competition.
Oh, boy.
Along with a rumored 50,000 other young women. And the point of the whole contest was to see who had the closest physical measurements to Alexandros of Antioch's Venus de Milo statue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The striking Dorothea ended up winning with an article in the New York Evening World writing that she was, and this is a very weird series of things that they wrote, Dorothea was an exact flesh and blood replica of the marble Venus of the Louvre. And they said that Dorothea possessed springing, supple lines, had an arresting charm, along with a perfectly modeled, perfectly managed body.
Okay.
I need you to calm down, early 1900s.
Wow.
I need you to calm down.
That was all very risque. All
right. Right?
All right. Come on, girl.
So the win earned the self-proclaimed former tomboy, she called herself, quite a bit of attention from people near and far, including several men who wrote to her begging for her hand in marriage. However, only one man seemed to matter to her, and that was Navy officer Ernest J. Turley. Mm. I do believe she called him Ernie, which is adorable. Ernest was born in Texas around 1888 or 1889 to Benjamin Franklin and Martha Foree Turney.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. From what I could find, it looks like his mother died when he was around 9 or 10, but that's really all the information on him prior to meeting Dorothea that I could find. In any event, Dorothea and Ernest eloped in 1918, and 9 months later, they welcomed their first child, a daughter named Maddie Malden Turley. My favorite part is that Malden is the city where she was born.
Wow, really into it.
Yeah. Which I'll get to more of that, because goddamn.
Oh, boy.
So, the little family then moved to Boston, where their son David Ernest Turley was born in 1919. Letters from admirers still occasionally found their way to Dorothea, though they were mostly congratulating on her marriage and her children by now. Eventually, the letters and fanfare stopped, but Dorothea was happy with her little family and her new life. Mm-hmm. After a while, Ernest retired from the Navy, and the family moved again, this time to Coronado, California. Everything went super well for the next few years, though there is some speculation that Dorothea wasn't super stoked about the change in their financial situation after Ernest retired. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's true, Dorothea started experiencing some health issues, largely asthma and sinus problems. And at the recommendation of a friend, the Turleys decided to head out to Arizona for an extended vacation, believing the drier climate would be good for Dorothea's health. As sure. You do. They packed up and arrived at their new homestead in August of 1933, which would be like moving to the surface of the sun, but okay.
Right?
Good Lord. The house that they rented was said to be more of a shack.
Ooh.
Or, quote-unquote, an ugly rented cabin.
Oh.
In the White Mountains, where their only neighbors were allegedly some cowpunchers, a.k.a. cattle ranchers and cowboys. I learned that phrase and had to share it because it's hilarious. The actual definition is a hired hand who tends cattle and performs other duties on horseback, for anyone that may have been as curious as I was.
Yeah.
Because... like
cow punchers.
What the hell? But it's, apparently
it's cowboys.
It was cowboys and ranchers on horseback poking and prodding all of the cows into where they needed to go with some kind of implement. Yeah. And I was like, sure.
Herding cattle.
It's not clever, it's literal.
Yes.
Cow puncher, literally. Yep. And I was like, well, this is just fucking great. It tickled
cow poke.
Exactly.
Right?
Same. Cowboy. Made me just tickled me mm-hmm. pink for mm-hmm. whatever reason. Mm-hmm. In any event, onward we go.
Do go on.
About a month into her new life in Arizona, Dorothea became a little bored, resentful. I mean, she was used to living in more metropolitan areas.
Right.
So the isolation of their new situation was clearly not for her. Mm. And because there was little else to do, she procured a Ouija board at some point and started holding little seances to pass the time. Sure.
Okay.
One September afternoon, Dorothea decided to take a little walk because, again, not much else to do, and ended up stumbling upon some ancient indigenous petroglyphs carved into the rocks. I'm not sure which tribe this would have been from, but according to ArizonaWhiteMountains.net, 2 miles north of Springerville, the Casa Malpace ruins are home to the Mogollon tribe and a national historic landmark. The Mogollon, Sinagua, Anasazi, and Hohokam tribes were the primary inhabitants of the region from 1100 to 1400 AD. Mm-hmm. Super relevant to the story? Not entirely, but it's kind of important when we learn what happened next in a sort of historical sense. So Dorothea finds these carvings, immediately decides that there's something more to them, and heads home to ask her board for more information. At that point, the spirit she's communicating with tells her that there's gold buried under that specific rock.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. She then manages to convince Ernest, who is unaware of the source of his wife's information at this point, that he should go out and start digging for gold. And also maybe just casually blast the area with a little dynamite to really get things going. Mm-hmm. Which he did, effectively destroying the art of a local indigenous tribe.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah. Not.
That's not
fucking
good.
Great.
No, that's not cool.
So, Ernest searched the spot for a while and came up empty-handed. Confused, Dorothea consulted the board again, and it allegedly told her it had made a mistake.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Sure.
Yes.
Okay.
I know. Somehow, Ernest discovered that his wife, whether she told him, he caught her, I don't know, but he found out that that's where she got her information from. Just, you know, a little tip from the Ouija board that there's gold under a rock that he spent days, I'm assuming, doing backbreaking labor to find.
Yeah.
Only to find out that, no, it was a Ouija board that told her that. So he was a little pissed. He was a little pissed. This led to several fights between them over the next couple of months, with one paper alleging that on occasion, on one occasion, Dorothea screamed, "Every time I look at you, I want to kill you," to her husband. Which is not great. It's not good. It's not great. I also did find that in the transcript from the eventual trial that it was testified in court that this is what she said. So
Jesus.
Yeah, not great. It's really not good.
Come on, girl.
Any hoops. So they fight, whatever. Soon enough, Dorothea started holding these seances with Maddie.
Okay.
Why? Well, loneliness was a factor, I'm sure, but she may have also had another ulterior motive. Leading up to Ernest's attempted murder, Dorothea and Maddie started asking questions about the guns he'd purchased for both kids. Specifically, what their range was and how far away they'd need to be to take out a deer.
Okay.
He told them roughly 20 yards should do the trick. And if that weren't suspect and highly questionable enough, Dorothea also started asking Ernest about his life insurance policy.
Okay.
Apparently, he had two of them, totaling $5,000 total.
Okay.
Which in today's money is roughly $116,680.
In the scheme of things, not a lot. But I mean, but not for the rest of your life. But I mean, yeah, I guess.
Back then, by 1933?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good chunk of change.
That is. Oh, yeah, no, that's good.
For 1933.
That's true.
Fairly decent. True. Financial gain seems like motive enough for someone to kill their spouse that apparently they hate. But of course, that wasn't the only reason. According to the rumor mill, and later Maddie herself, mm-hmm. the 38-year-old Dorothea had fallen for a 22-year-old cowboy, Kent Pierce.
Okay.
And if that name is familiar, yeah, the very same dude that came to the Turley home the night that Ernest was shot.
Okay.
Allegedly, Kent was the person who showed the Turleys around the area when they got into town and was even the one that showed them the house that they'd end up renting. In one article...
Mama was bored.
Real bored. In one article, they wrote that Kent, quote-unquote, had all the outward appearance of a movie-type cowpuncher. Big hat, wow. Neckerchief, tight pants, bow legs and all.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bow legs and all.
Let me tell you, them bow legs really get my fanny a-fluttering, I guess.
Well, you know, when you've been riding a horse a long time, that's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
Get them cowboy legs.
Especially if you're wearing them tight jeans.
Oh.
Your legs can't, they have no option but to stay there.
Tight jeans, yeah.
And he wore tight pants.
And a kerchief.
A neckerchief, specifically.
Oh, sorry, neckerchief. My bad.
And a big hat.
Big hat.
Movie cowboy.
Movie cowboy.
Yeah.
The silver screen cowboy.
Yep. apparently, both he and Dorothea had dreams of stardom in their heads, so they had that in common, I guess. In any event, it would later come out that the pair spent an awful lot of time together, including scenic drives through the mountains that occasionally lasted all night.
Weird.
Mm. Sometimes Maddie would tag along on these excursions.
Even weirder.
Well, and Kent would bring a boy her age named Pollard Wiltbank. Great cowboy name.
Yeah.
Pollard Wiltbank. He actually sounds like a Victorian child in...
Pollard Wiltbank.
Short pants.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was.
Ruffly short pants.
Ruffly short pants.
Well, he was around Maddie's age, so okay. He has bypassed the Victorian area. Got it. Just he was sounds...
born early 1900s. Got it.
And in Arizona. I don't feel like those were...
It's a hell of a name,
though. In the mountain range with the cattle folk.
No.
I don't feel like velvet short pants were particularly popular.
No.
But his name calls to another time.
That is true.
Another place. He would bring along Pollard Wiltbank to keep Maddie company while they went on these weird drives. In an article by Lynn Peril, she writes that the couple, and this is their quote, like Dorothea before him, Pierce dreamed of a movie career. Maddie testified that her mother and Pierce frequently drove out of town for late night petting parties with 14-year-old Maddie and a friend of Pierce's in the back seat, once the foursome stayed out until morning. I have a hell of a good time on the Mesa, Dorothea told a neighbor.
Oh, good.
End quote.
A hell of a good time on the Mesa.
Hell of a good time out on the Mesa.
Oh, Dorothea's getting down.
She fucking is. Mrs. Lily Walk, which is another great name. She was a neighbor. She later testified that Mrs. Turley spoke openly of her wishes to marry the young cowboy.
Oh.
She would also go on to testify that Kent Pierce, and this is a quote from her actual testimony, Kent Pierce brought me some pork chops and said Mrs. Turley had sent me some pork chops and said to tell me to keep my mouth shut.
Oh.
Oh, boy.
Oh, here's these pork chops. Shut the fuck up.
Well, I'm going to need you to tell Mrs. Turley right back to stop fucking telling me things then.
Right?
There ain't shit else to do out here, Dorothea.
Damn.
Stop telling me your secrets. If you don't want me to share them.
Damn. Under oath.
Right? Well, she would just tell her, be like, I want to marry that boy. And then Dorothea turns around like, shut the fuck up. Have some fucking pork, you bitch. Be like, I'm going to need something entirely different if you want me to keep my mouth shut.
Right.
I mean, this will do it for a minute, but.
A minute.
No.
Fair enough.
I need better bribes than pork chops if you want me to shut up forever.
Touché.
Now, it wasn't really a secret that the two of them were canoodling around, but I also don't think that Ernest really had any idea that it was going on. Or if he did, he didn't seem to do anything with the information. Maybe he didn't care. Maybe he's like, yeah, you fucking handle her. I'm going to try and be a cowboy now.
Mm-hmm.
Do whatever you will.
Sure.
I don't care. I don't know. There's no... nothing I could find that told me either way if he knew or if he didn't. With all that, let's circle the wagons back to what brought us this far. The Ouija board. So after Maddie confessed to the shooting, purposeful shooting of her father, police informed Dorothea of the information that her daughter had just shared with them. She lost her mind, insisting that the officer had strong-armed Maddie into a false confession.
Oh boy.
Maddie, however, said that the officers had nothing to do with the confession and that she'd confessed, and this is her quote from court, because it was the right thing to do.
Okay.
Which, for being a month away from 15, pretty fucking stand, like a stand-up situation, all things considered.
Right.
For her to be like, no, it was me. Like, I want to put this right. Which, good for you. Mm-hmm. A lot of adults don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Ernest had been transported from a local Apache County hospital to the U.S. Naval Hospital in San Diego. When he found out that the shooting was intentional, he reportedly said that, when I'm able to go back to Arizona to prosecute my daughter to the full extent of the law for her attempt to murder me.
Oof.
When I'm able, I'm going back, is what he said. He wouldn't get the chance.
Uh-oh.
Ernest Turley died on December 26, 1933, 6 weeks after being shot and just 4 days after his daughter's appearance in court.
From infection?
Probably.
Yeah, okay. So then nothing else happened?
No. Okay, he died from his injuries.
Got it.
Yeah. On December 22nd, 1933, Maddie stood before a judge in juvenile court and pled guilty to an attempted murder charge. Because remember, at the time, her father was still alive when the hearing was happening. He died 4 days afterwards. Mm-hmm. So during the hearing, Maddie testified that, and this is a quote, "Mother asked the Ouija board to decide between father and her cowboy friend. As usual, the board moved around at first without meaning, but suddenly it spelled out, 'I was to kill father.' It was terrible. I shook all over. Mother asked the Ouija board if the shooting would be successful, and it said that it would. She asked if he would die outright, and it said no. We asked what should be used in the shooting, and it said a shotgun. We asked if we would have the ranch, and it said yes. We asked about the law, and it said not to fear the law, everything would turn out all right. We asked how much insurance would be, and it said $5,000. I tried to kill father the next day, but I couldn't. I lost my nerve. A few days later, though, I followed him to the corral. I raised the gun and took careful aim between the shoulders, but then I lost my nerve again. But I thought of dear mother and what all of this would mean to her. I couldn't fail.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
My hand was trembling awfully, but I raised the gun and fired.
Okay.
On January 18th, 1934, at the recommendation of the county attorney, Maddie was sentenced to spend 6 years at the Arizona State School for Girls in Randolph, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Of the relatively lenient sentence, because Ernest had died in this interim, the attorney said that it was largely due to the fact that Maddie, quote-unquote, is very much broken up over the whole affair. In Lynn Peril's article, she wrote, "They thought I wouldn't take the rap," Maddie said, "but I killed Daddy and I want to pay for it. That's the only way I can show the world and him how sorry I am." When she was taken away to begin serving her sentence at the grim-sounding state school for girls, Dorothea told her, in what Maddie called a cold and sarcastic tone,
"Oh, Jesus.
I thank you for your cooperation. Be a good girl." End quote.
Oh.
Yeah.
Goo.
Yeah. Hate
That's
it.
That's not great.
Just, and as a couple podcasts have pointed out that I've listened to about this case, it sounds like something out of a fucking movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Dorothea, dramatic, full of the drama. Mm-hmm. So I can absolutely see her saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your cooperation. Be a good girl. I hate it.
That's
like a real cunty thing to say to your daughter after convincing her to kill her own dad.
Wow.
Be a good girl. Eat a dick, Dorothea.
She did.
Yeah. Well, I'll get to that. Just one moment. So, naturally, no one fully believed that Maddie was the one to concoct this plan of her own volition. They were like, sure. She is just barely 15 years old at this point. There's no way.
No.
So, Dorothea Turley was arrested and held on a $5,000 bail.
Oh.
And this is... And again, an official quote from the court records, "for the crime of assault with intent to commit murder."
Oh, good.
She wound up sitting in jail awaiting trial for the next 5 months. And as you can imagine, the papers had a field day.
Oh, yeah.
In the meantime.
Oh, yeah.
Maddie was brought in to testify during Dorothea's trial, where she recounted her story to the jury. While on the stand, she informed the jury that... "It was not an accident. I did it on purpose so mother could marry her handsome cowboy. I had to do it. Ouija ordered me to, and when Ouija commands, it must be obeyed."
Oh, God.
She also told them that during one of their seances, which was reported to have taken place on November 8th, which was less than 2 weeks before the shooting, the board had spelled out, "Daddy must die."
Ooh.
And in some places it says, "kill your daddy."
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was actually, "daddy must die." And when they asked who'd be the one to kill Ernest, the planchette went to the letters M and T, which Dorothea claimed stood for Maddie Turley. Maddie would also go on to testify that her mother had used playing cards as a kind of occult second opinion.
Dorothea's too much.
She does the most and then some. So, of this, Maddie explained, saying, "The Queen of Hearts was to stand for mother, the king for the cowboy she wanted to marry, the 10-spot diamond for father, and the ace of spades for death. Time and again, the king and queen came up together, and the 10-spot and ace were paired. That meant death for daddy."
Okay.
Rightfully terrified at the thought of killing her own father, Maddie asked multiple times if she had to follow through with it, and was told that whatever the board said was the way it had to be. Testifying that, "I asked mother if I had to do what the Ouija board said, and she told me there was no escaping its command. Mother told me the Ouija board could not be denied, and that I would not even be arrested for doing it."
You're okay.
Dorothea was incensed at her daughter's story, testifying that the teen had been angry at both of her parents, saying, and this is her quote, "Maddie was angry with her father and me. We didn't want her to use rouge or to run around at night with cow punchers or to cross her legs the way she did or to wear such short dresses. She's been influenced. She's been influenced to place the blame for this killing on me because some of the cowboys didn't like me." Ma'am, what the fuck does one thing have to do with the other? In another blow to Dorothea's ego, when Kent Pierce took the stand, he stated in no uncertain terms that he played absolutely no part in Ernest's murder plot, that it was all Dorothea's idea, and, nail in the coffin, that he never had any plans to marry her.
Oh. Ouch.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Ouch.
He was like, no.
Oh, boy. That blows. Oops.
I'm a cow puncher, and I got that whole cow for free.
He punched that hole.
He did punch that hole.
So, up on the mesa.
Sure fucking did.
Ayo. Hole punching on the mesa.
Y'all may have had a hell of a time on the mesa together, but mm-hmm. he wasn't looking for anything else, girl.
Nope.
Whoops.
Whoopsie.
Needless to say.
Oh, Dorothea.
She's not too stoked about that. But it didn't really matter, because in July, Dorothea was sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison.
Oh, good.
For her part in her husband's murder.
Oh, good.
So what happened to Maddie and Dorothea after their trials? Well, Maddie did spend some time at the state school for girls, but not the whole 6 years. Why? Because it closed down in 1935 or 1936.
Oh, okay. So she did, what, two or three?
Yeah. The facility was meant for young women with both criminal pasts and mental health issues, but why would a reform school for girls close after less than a decade of operation? It was only open for like 8 years. Thanks to Chris over at the Buried Secrets podcast, the Attorney General's office claimed that the school was shut down for financial reasons. Okay.
Fair enough.
However, after a little digging, Chris found a dissertation from 1963 that was written by a county juvenile court intern, which stated that, and this was from the dissertation, the school was abolished by the legislature in 1935 due to scandal caused by alleged sexual relations between the girls and prisoners from the state prison in Florence who took care of the maintenance work for the school. Big time yikes.
That's not great.
No.
That's bad.
It's not good.
It's real bad.
It's not awesome.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. So after the school was closed, Maddie.
Very scandalous.
Very scandalous. So after that closed down, Maddie was moved to a secret location, which would eventually be revealed to be the Convent of the Good Shepherd in Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
It was kept secret in order to keep her whereabouts from the press and her own mother.
Oh, yeah.
In May of 1935, after spending a couple years working in the prison library, Dorothea appealed her conviction and was granted a new trial by the Supreme Court of Arizona. In June of 1936, Dorothea was acquitted of all charges.
Wow!
After the Supreme Court found that the original trial hadn't allowed any testimony regarding the character of Maddie Turley in court, thereby causing prejudice amongst the jury. Somehow. She was officially released from the Apache County Jail, where she'd been transferred in order to await a second trial that never happened. Mm-hmm. And that took place on September 12th, 1936. After which, she informed the press that she would be working to get Maddie released as well, so they could go join David, who'd been living with Dorothea's mother in New York. I don't think either one of the Turley kids were down for that plan, considering David had allegedly told his sister, Now you've done what you wanted to do to her. I hope you're satisfied. Following their mother's original trial and hearing.
Wow.
And sentencing. Yeah. So, yikes. We actually know for a fact that Maddie had zero desire to rejoin her mother because she told her as much. So Dorothea ended up getting a court order for her daughter's location after she was released. So Dorothea was released and then got the court order to find out where Maddie was. But when she showed up to the convent, she was given a note from Maddie stating that she did not want to see her.
Good.
Just a note. She's like, no fucking thanks.
Yeah, get the fuck out of here.
A couple sources say that Maddie eventually relented, but only to tell her mother that she never wanted to see her again.
Yeah, bye, bitch.
Yeah. On November 30th, 1936, the now 18-year-old was quietly released from the convent, and according to Superior Judge Levi S. Udell,
yeah,
the judge that granted her parole, this girl has received too much publicity. She has to live life. She has her life to live, and I think she should be left alone.
Fair.
Which is fair. The parole and anonymity were granted in Maddie's best interests because of Dorothea's own release.
Yeah.
Very early release. In April of 1938, Dorothea filed a $75,000 lawsuit against Mrs. Thelma Bradford Bailey, the former superintendent slash matron of the girls' school, and Mr. Bailey, her husband, for, quote-unquote, alienation of affection and poisoning Maddie's mind while they were both incarcerated in their respective facilities. Shockingly, the suit was thrown out in 1939 with Dorothea receiving nary a penny.
Good.
Agreed. Next to nothing is known about the Turleys after this. According to an entry by Norm Smart of Melbourne, Australia, over on findgrave.com, David Turley became a merchant marine, but was sadly killed on December 2nd, 1942.
Uh-oh.
He was among the 186 people aboard the SS Coamo when it was torpedoed and sank by a German submarine. He was only 22 or 23 years old when he died. Yeah. As for Dorothea, I tried to do a little digging to see what happened to her, but it wasn't very easy to find information after her last lawsuit was thrown out in 1939. However, I did find an entry for Ernest Turley on a genealogy website, so I followed the links, and it looks like Ms. Dorothea may have changed her name at some point and gotten remarried, but remember, this isn't confirmed, just an interesting thing I found that may be something or not.
Right.
So I was looking over Dorothea's page. There was a link to a similar record attached to Dorothea's tree, which you have to, somebody has to go in and link those things. Mm-hmm. So somebody did that.
Okay.
And you have to have, like, you have to have an account to create these family trees. So someone had to go in and create these two separate entities and then link them together. Mm-hmm. So this is why I'm like, well, maybe this is what happened, because it wasn't just a random name.
Right.
So I followed this link, and it took me to the page of a woman named Irene Hansen. Irene was Dorothea's middle name.
Ah.
And from the records I found, both Dorothea and Irene happened to have the same January 1895 birthday.
Okay.
Same birthday.
Uh-huh.
Both women also had the same death date of November 27th, 1972. And they were both listed as being buried in San Diego, California.
Interesting.
If it is the same person, it would appear that she relocated to California at some point and got remarried.
Okay.
So.
And goes by her middle name.
Exactly. Which feels.
Yeah.
Probable.
Yeah.
Despite a very thorough search on my part, there is no information available on what became of Maddie Turley after she was paroled in 1936. Okay. And when I say thorough.
Oh, I believe it,
babe. I mean it.
Oh, I believe you. I believe you. You're real good at that.
Thank you. Yeah. I fucking nothing. But I'm assuming she also changed her name and just vanished and lived her life.
And you went down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, I'm sure. Did
for fucking anything. There was one.
Been there.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
The bizarre story of the Ouija board murder of Ernest Turley.
That's a good one.
Right? Thank you.
Fucking Dorothea, man. But the fucking bitch.
The drama, ma'am.
Jesus Christ.
Good Lord, madam.
Drama.
My sources were rd.com, Lauren Kahn. That's the Reader's Digest. Uboat.net. Ranker.com, Harrison Tenpas, Wikitree.com, Listverse.com, Robert Grimink.
Sure.
Sorry. Wikipedia.org, Hilobrow.com, Lynn Peril, law.umich.edu, University of Michigan, Megan Barrett Casino, findagrave.com, vocabulary.com, courtlistener.com, Turley versus State of Arizona, 1936. News.google.com, an AP article for the Spokesman Review from December 1st, 1936. DRVITELE.iPad.com. AZWhiteMountains.net, AmericanHeritage.com, James P. Johnson, MyFavoriteMurder.com, USInflationCalculator.com, BuriedSecretsPodcast.com, Chris Amandier, TheHiddenPod.wordpress.com, a piece by The Hidden Staircase Podcast by Samantha and Shane, UnknownMisandry.blogspot.com, Buried Secrets Podcast, episode Kill Daddy, The Turley Ouija Board Murder, Ouija Boards Part 9 from 7/24/2020, and that one is also by Chris Amandier, and My Favorite Murder Podcast, episode 378, Gloved Hand Gesture, as told by Georgia Hardstark.
Well, shit fire.
Jeez. Dorothea, girl.
Ma'am.
Zero chill.
She said.
Fucking zero chill.
Yeah.
None chill.
She
had...
Mommy dearest, none chill.
Not a chill.
None.
Nary a chill.
Nary
a chill to be found.
Yeah.
Just, It reminded me of, and now again I have forgotten the case.
Sardines.
No.
Mm-mm.
The one I covered with the first case of someone being literally ghosted by a ghost. The girl with the Ouija board that she wanted to be her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, honey, it's very obviously you spelling these things out to yourself.
Oh, bless her heart,
bless
too.
Bless your heart. But, you know, with that one just was sad and no murder. And this one was...
just sad.
Murder.
This one was... She was using that Ouija board to manipulate her child, and that's not nice.
Yeah, Dorothea's kind of fucked.
Manipulating her child to murder her own father.
So that she can run off with a cowboy that don't want to run off with her.
Uh-huh.
I misunderstood the assignment.
It's okay. It's okay. I saw you. You were working. You were doing work.
You were doing work stuff.
I was multitasking and trying to catch details.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was like, oh, no. Oh, bless it. Dorothea.
She's...
Girl, but she was gorgeous.
I'm sure that cowboy was hot.
Also, I haven't actually seen photos. I've just seen several photos of Dorothea. And
I believe
it. She was
And isn't Babe? He hot? Wasn't he 20?
Yeah, he was 22. She was 38.
Yeah.
Babetown.
Babetown,
population,
USA.
Population, that lady.
Yeah.
Population,
both of them.
Population, Dorothea Turley and that guy, except he was like, no.
He's like, guess what? No, thank you.
I got what I needed.
Sure did. Up on that mesa.
Hell of a time.
Yeah. Yeah, just got poked up on the mesa, so.
Cow punching on the mesa.
Cow punching, poking on the mesa.
Well, or we said hole punching.
That too.
Hole punching.
Hole punching. I did say hole punching.
You did. Hole punching on the mesa?
Yep. Fuck yeah. So.
That.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Thank you.
It's a great one.
Thank
you. Well, we fucking done it, y'all.
We did done do it.
So.
Well, I didn't do it.
Yep. Y'all know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe, share.
Uh-huh.
If you'd like some exclusive motherfucking content, go become a patron on our La Patron.
Yes, please.
Take it away.
Anytime to podcast.
There you go.
You know.
Yeah, do that.
You know the code.
You know the stuff.
You know the stuff and things.
Yeah. You've been here.
We get new listeners. Go back like 3 weeks and listen to that one.
Do that.
Yeah.
There we go.
It's all on right there.
It's not there. On last week's.
It's there. Yeah. So, all right. Well, till next time, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Hats off to the Fuck You Club.
So many.
So many. New Jersey State Transit Police, guys.
Oh yeah.
Guys.
You know what? Let's take it beyond that. Fuck New Jersey.
Sure.
Fuck you, New Jersey. Okay, you know what? If you're a listener and you're from there, New Jersey's a great and wonderful place. If you're not, fuck New Jersey.
I've only been there one time, and it was to a random train station.
I'm sure.
To go to New York.
I'm sure there are gorgeous parts of New Jersey.
I'm sure.
It is a stereotypical shithole.
Yes.
So I just kind of roll with what I know.
Went with it.
Yeah. The whole transit police, all the investigators on Tiffany's case. Yeah. Fuck you.
Yeah. Huh?
Fuck you.
Yeah.
Dorothea. You shitting with,
yeah,
girl.
Dorothea, fuck you, girl.
For real.
Come on. You set your kid up. That's fucked.
That's truly.
That's super fucked. So... Fuck you, Bob.
Always.
Ted.
Yeah. Bip. Fuck you, Bip.
Bip.
Kimberly can't read.
Nope.
Fuck you, Gwyneth.
Yeah, especially.
Oh, and fuck you, Robert. Don't forget Robert.
Never forget Robert. And Ted.
Did I say Ted?
No,
fuck
Robert.
Ted!
Fuck Ted.
Fuck Ted!
My mouth tastes like corn.
Eat shit, Ted. Yeah. I ate all those chips.
Good.
Nice.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about it now.
Well, not the popcorn ones. Those are...
Yeah.
And I drank that whole sparkling water, so I've got the twitchies because I'm about to piss myself. So.
And
someone's got to pee.
Someone's
got to pee. And that person that's got to pee is me.
She's
going to
pee out of her vagina.